Ekatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome to the Deep Dive. We're the place you come to get the essentials from key sources, torn apart, analyzed, and put back together so you get the knowledge you need. Fast and hopefully pretty fascinating.
Absolutely. And today we're tackling a book that honestly might just change how you look at, well, pretty much every human interaction you have. It's Robert Rutt's The Moral Animal.
The Moral Animal. Yeah, that title itself, it kind of grabs you, doesn't it? Sets up this tension right away between, you know, moral and animal.
Exactly. We tend to think of morality as something separate, something higher than our basic instincts. But our mission today is to unpack Rutt's argument that our deepest morals, our strongest feelings, even things like love and guilt, are actually sophisticated evolutionary adaptations.
Right, shaped by natural selection. It's not just philosophy. It's trying to knit together biology and psychology. The book really pushes you to ask, why did evolution design us to feel love or jealousy? Or, you know, that sense of fairness.
And it suggests the answers to that big question, why do we behave the way we do, are buried deep in our genetic history. It's a pretty radical idea, really.
It is, because it suggests that even the stuff we think of as the most noble parts of human nature, compassion, justice, even deep committed love, might be at the root functional outputs, part of a genetic program honed over millennia.
A program whose main goal, Rutt argues, wasn't happiness or truth, but just maximizing reproductive success, getting those genes into the next generation.
Okay, so before we dive headfirst into that whole idea, let's talk about the author, Robert Rutt. Who is this guy bringing us this challenging message?
Well, Rutt's background is interesting. He's primarily a top-tier science writer, you know, writes for places like The New Yorker, The Atlantic. He's a Princeton guy, a scholar.
So he's not the original biologist doing the lab work, necessarily.
Right. Not primarily, no. He's more of a brilliant translator, a synthesist. He took all this complex academic work from evolutionary biology and psychology people like Trivers, Hamilton, and wove it into something accessible, something compelling for a general audience.
Like a bridge builder between the science labs and, well, us.
Precisely. And what makes his perspective stand out, I think, is his intellectual honesty. He doesn't sugarcoat the implications.
Yeah, I got that sense. He lays out the insights, but he also really leans into the uncomfortable bits, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Even when the science challenges our most cherished ideas about who we are.
Totally. He basically asks, if natural selection shaped our hands and eyes, why would it stop at the neck? Why wouldn't it shape the machinery of our thoughts and feelings too?
Okay, so let's get into the core premise of The Moral Animal. It's, well, it can be a bit unsettling, this gene-centric view applied to the human mind.
Right. The fundamental claim is that the main purpose of our minds, evolutionarily speaking, isn't achieving truth or finding happiness or creating world peace. Mm-hmm. It's maximizing the transmission of our own genes.
And our emotions are, what, just tools for that job?
Essentially, yeah. Instruments calibrated by natural selection over ages to guide our behavior toward that single goal, especially in the kind of environment our ancestors lived in.
Okay, that sounds kind of bleak.
Yeah.
Like, are things like free will or genuine, uncalculated happiness just illusions then, according to Rutt?
He definitely tackles that existential angle. The idea is that evolution selects for effectiveness in reproduction, not necessarily for subjective contentment or philosophical truth. The book's scope is massive. It tries to explain everything from mating choices to moral outrage, all through this lens of ancient genetic programming.
Wow. And the way he structures it is really clever, isn't it? Using Charles Darwin's own life.
Oh, yeah, that's brilliant. He uses Darwin's courtship of his wife Emma, his relationships, his chronic illnesses, all of it as this running case study.
The guy who discovered the theory becomes the test case for the theory. It's quite meta.
It really is. And it makes these abstract principles feel much more human and immediate, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It counters that criticism that evolutionary psychology is just cold reductionism.
Okay, let's unpack some of the key mechanisms Rutt explains, starting with the basics. Sex, romance, love. He leans heavily on parental investment theory. Right?
Exactly. That's Robert Trivers' big contribution. The core idea is this asymmetry in what it takes to reproduce.
Meaning?
Well, the sex that invests more time, energy, and resources into creating and raising offspring, which biologically and historically has been the female due to pregnancy, lactation, and often primary care.
Okay.
That sex becomes the scarcer resource in the mating market and therefore tends to be more selective. Looking for signs of commitment, resources, good genes.
Right. While the sex that invests less, typically the male, ends up competing more intensely for access to that scarcer resource.
Yeah.
And might be let's say, more inclined towards variety, more opportunistic.
That's the general pattern predicted by the theory, yeah. And it sets up these classic dynamics we see in courtship, relationships, and even conflict.
And you see this really clearly when Wright talks about jealousy, don't you? It's not just some irrational feeling.
Not at all. The theory predicts different triggers. Men, statistically, tend to be more distressed by sexual infidelity. The underlying evolutionary fear, paternity uncertainty, investing resources in offspring that don't carry your genes.
Whereas women, statistically, are more distressed by emotional infidelity.
Right. Because for ancestral women, the bigger threat was the potential loss of the partner's commitment, resources, and protection things crucial for her survival and the survival of her children. So that feeling of jealousy, it's like an ancient alarm system wired differently based on these biological stakes.
Wow. Okay. Accepting that love might have a cost-benefit analysis deep down is one thing. But then what about kindness? Why are we nice to people who aren't our family? If it's all about genetic self-interest, how did cooperation evolve?
Ah, yeah, that's the next big puzzle. And that brings us to the mechanisms behind altruism, kin selection, and reciprocal altruism.
Kin selection, that's about family, right?
Mm-hmm. W.D. Hamilton's idea. It explains why we often feel intense love and make sacrifices for relatives. Helping them, especially close relatives, indirectly helps copies of our own genes succeed. Think about intense parental love. It's the ultimate investment in your genetic future.
Okay, that makes intuitive sense. But cooperation with non-relatives, friends, colleagues, even strangers, that seems different.
That's where reciprocal altruism comes in another Trevor's concept. It's basically the evolutionary logic of you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. Cooperation can provide huge benefits, but it only works if people generally repay favors and don't cheat the system too much.
So we needed ways to manage that social accounting.
Exactly. And Wright argues that's where a lot of our social emotions come in. Gratitude motivates us to repay kindness. Guilt makes us feel bad when we cheat or fail to reciprocate, potentially repairing social bonds. Sympathy prompts us to help others in need, maybe anticipating future help in return.
And anger, like righteous anger when someone else cheats the system?
That's the enforcement mechanism. It motivates us to punish cheaters or freeloaders, maintaining the stability of the cooperative system. So even our feelings of kindness and fairness likely evolved because, on average, they served our long-term self-interest by helping us build and maintain crucial social alliances.
So cooperation exists, but it's always kind of shattered by competition and self-interest.
Pretty much. Which leads nicely into the next part, social strife, status, and deception.
Ah, status. Humans seem obsessed with it, don't we? Where we rank.
Deeply obsessed, because, evolutionarily speaking, higher status meant better access to everything important for survival and reproduction. Food, territory, safety, desirable mates. That drive for respect, for recognition, it's this ancient engine humming beneath a lot of modern life, from office politics to social media.
And Wright introduces this really fascinating, maybe disturbing idea here, self-deception.
Yeah, this is a core concept. He argues it might be the mind's ultimate evolutionary trick. The idea is, if we can genuinely convince ourselves that our underlying motives, maybe for status or resources or punishing a rival, are actually noble, selfless, or purely about justice,
then we become much more convincing liars to other people.
Exactly. If you believe your own spin, you don't give off those subtle cues of deception. Your righteousness feels authentic because at a conscious level, it is authentic to you.
He uses that analogy of the conscious mind being like a press secretary for our underlying genetic motives, right?
The subconscious gene-driven motives make the calculation, this action benefits me, and then the conscious mind, the press secretary, spins it publicly, I'm doing this for the greater good, or this is about principle.
We become masters of hypocrisy without even realizing it, genuinely believing our own PR.
It helps explain how people can do things that clearly benefit their own reputation or status while sincerely believing they're acting out of pure altruism or moral conviction.
Okay. But if our brains are constantly running this internal propaganda campaign for our genes, how do we ever get objective? How do we, like, fire the press secretary and see our real motives?
That's the million-dollar question, and it leads into the final crucial part of the book, the morals of the story. Wright fully acknowledges that our evolved sense of morality isn't necessarily a guide to some universal truth.
It's more like a tool.
Yeah, a suite of adaptations for social maneuvering, reputation management, and coalition building. Our sense of fairness is often incredibly biased towards ourselves and our in-group. We're naturally better at spotting hypocrisy in others than in ourselves.
And this is where he really emphasizes the danger of the naturalistic fallacy, isn't it?
That's like a critical point. This is the mistake of assuming that just because something is natural or evolved, that means it's good or right.
So explaining the evolutionary roots of, say, tribalism or suspicion of outsiders doesn't mean we endorse xenophobia.
Not at all. It's a scientific explanation for why we might have those biases, not a moral justification for them. Wright argues that understanding these innate tendencies, these evolutionary demons, as he sometimes calls them, is the essential first step.
You have to know your own programming before you can consciously choose to act differently.
Precisely. Recognizing the ancient roots of an intuition, maybe an impulse towards prejudice or status-driven aggression or self-serving moralizing, gives you the chance to evaluate it with reason rather than just acting on it blindly. Understanding our nature is the prerequisite for genuine moral progress.
Yeah, okay, let's zoom out a bit. If you had to distill the main messages, the key themes from The Moral Animal, what would they be?
I think the first big one is that constant tension, that paradox between self-interest and altruism.
Right. We have genuine feelings of love, empathy, kindness. But the capacity for those feelings evolved because ultimately they helped our ancestors' genes survive and reproduce.
Mm-hmm. And the reflection for us, I think, is recognizing that our altruism, therefore, has natural limits and biases. We're wired to favor kin, close friends, our tribe. Extending that circle requires conscious effort against the grain of our evolved defaults.
Okay, theme one, the paradox. What's next?
Theme two has got to be the modern mismatch problem. Our psychology was shaped for a very different world, small hunter-gatherer bands on the African savannah.
And now we're living in giant, anonymous, technologically advanced societies. We're running Stone Age software on spaceship hardware.
You got it. Think about our craving for sugar and fat, super adaptive when calories were sparse, but disastrous in today's world of abundance. Or think about tribal loyalty, essential for small group survival, but potentially catastrophic when it fuels modern nationalism or political polarization on a global scale.
We're constantly battling our own design specs.
Pretty much. And the third key theme, I'd say, is the unconscious nature of so many of these evolutionary influences. We don't usually decide to feel jealous or morally outraged based on a rational calculation of genetic benefit.
No, it just hits you. It feels real urgent.
Right. We feel these powerful urges, recognizing that these feelings bubble up from deep ancient programming rather than emerging purely from conscious, logical thought. That recognition itself gives you a bit of critical distance. It lets you pause and ask, okay, why am I feeling this so strongly right now?
That awareness is power.
Oh.
Okay, the book is also full of these really memorable, almost aphoristic lines that capture these big ideas.
Oh, definitely. Some real zingers that stick with you.
Like maybe the most famous one? We are built to be effective animals, not happy ones.
Mm-hmm. That one hits hard. Evolution cared about reproductive success, not necessarily our subjective well-being. It explains why achieving a goal often brings only fleeting satisfaction before our minds latch onto the next thing. Happiness wasn't the primary design goal.
And related to that self-awareness point, the first step toward wisdom is recognizing that our feelings aren't always wise advisors.
Yeah, that's crucial. Our feelings evolved to motivate us in an ancestral environment. They're powerful, but they aren't infallible guides, especially not in the modern world. We need reason to evaluate them, to decide if acting on them is actually wise or beneficial now.
They're like very convincing internal lobbyists for our genes agenda.
Good way to put it. And maybe one more, kind of the bedrock principle. The genes that built our brains were selected for their power to create organisms that would spread copies of themselves.
It just hammers home that our minds are fundamentally functional tools shaped for a specific evolutionary purpose, not necessarily detached, truth-seeking machines. Mm-hmm. Explains our focus on things like status, reputation, relationships.
Exactly. It's a powerful, if sometimes uncomfortable, lens to look through.
So how do we actually use this knowledge day to day? If we understand this evolutionary programming, what are the real-life applications?
Well, take personal relationships. Understanding something like parental investment theory can actually foster empathy, I think.
How so?
When conflicts arise, maybe about commitment levels or money or even housework, recognizing that some of the underlying friction might stem from these deep-seated, evolved differences in mating strategies rather than just personal flaws or stubbornness.
It allows you to maybe see the conflicts from a different angle. less judgmentally.
Right. It doesn't excuse bad behavior, but it can lead to more compassionate understanding of where the other person might be coming from, evolutionarily speaking.
Okay, that makes sense. What about just understanding ourselves better?
That's huge. Self-awareness. Using this knowledge to critically examine your own motives. Like you said earlier, that moment you feel intense moral outrage online, or you're feeling super competitive about something trivial.
You can pause and ask, is this really about justice or the objective issue? Or is my inner moral animal just trying to score status points or defend its coalition using moral language as a tool?
That kind of intellectual honesty is maybe the biggest practical payoff. It gives you a fighting chance to override those ancient, self-serving impulses when reason tells you they're misplaced.
And professionally, in the workplace.
Same principles apply. Recognizing the deep roots of status hierarchies, office politics, the importance of reciprocity and reputation, it can help you navigate those dynamics more skillfully. Build genuine alliances based on trust and competence rather than just, you know, superficial maneuvering. Understand why gossip is so prevalent, why reputation matters so much.
So, looking back on this whole deep dive, what's the final takeaway for you? What really stands out?
For me, it comes back to that profound irony you mentioned earlier, using Darwin's own intensely private life, his anxieties, his marriage, as the ultimate case study for the theory he discovered. It's just, wow. His personal struggles were, in a way, living proof of his scientific revolution.
Yeah, that really lands the point. For me, I think the single most valuable lesson is simply that self-knowledge is power. Truly understanding the evolutionary forces that shape our thoughts and feelings doesn't have to be depressing or deterministic.
Right, it's the opposite.
It gives you more conscious control. It allows you to identify your own biases, your own ancient programming, and then consciously choose whether to follow it or to strive for something better, a more rational or ethical or compassionate path.
Exactly. The scientific understanding of our animal nature is precisely what enables us to become more truly moral in the sense of making conscious, informed choices rather than just being puppets of our instincts. It's challenging stuff, but absolutely essential, I think.
A really powerful framework for thinking about ourselves and society. We definitely encourage you to explore Robert Wright's work further if this sparked your curiosity.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.